You are listening to a Side Streets production.
1, 2, 3, 4!
Hey, let's go to town. Hey, maybe I'll show you around. Hey, let's go to town on the weekend. All the best of summer Side Street. Might be hot, but it's a dry heat,
Hello and welcome to the Side Streets Podcast, episode number 054. We are breaking new ground on the podcast today. For the first time on this or any other show, we are talking about stand-up comedy. I know, right? You can't find any podcast anywhere else that is going to get into what stand-up comics do to prepare or how they handle the check drop. I'm going to drop this bit. You can find plenty of places to listen to stand-up comics talk about their process. But the reason I wanted to have today's guest, Bethany Evans, on the show was on those podcasts, you don't typically get to hear from somebody who's just starting. It's always somebody that's been doing it for years and years and has all these road stories. And, you know, if you listen to Mark Maron's podcast, you know what I'm talking about. But today what we wanted to get into was what it takes to get up on stage for the first time, what it feels like when you get that first laugh, what makes you want to keep doing it even when it doesn't go well, or even when you don't feel like you're comfortable yet, what keeps you plowing through. Bethany's been doing stand-up comedy for about 5 months now, and I first saw her perform at the end of February. She was opening up Romo Tonight. Now, you guys remember Romo. He was our guest back on episode 047, and his once-a-month late-night variety show has turned out to be this incredible place for Tucson's comics to get to perform in front of people they wouldn't otherwise get to perform for. Now, I love stand-up comedy, and I have undying love and admiration for anybody that has the guts to get up there and perform in this way. But for one reason or another, I just don't go see it that often. I'm not totally familiar with what the comedy scene here is like. I know that we have a few really hardworking, really funny comics that are working to build this infrastructure for this community to perform. And the thing about a town like Tucson that doesn't necessarily have a firm, established comedy clique is that the barrier for entry is really low. And if you're funny, and if you're talented, and if you're nice, you can get stage time right away, and you can start to get good. And that's a lot of what Bethany and I talk about in this conversation. So for the past couple years, Bethany's been involved with the Female Storytellers, fstorytellers.com. It's something that allowed her to get on stage and tell stories and kind of work through some of those initial nerves and figure out, is this something she wants to do? And it turns out she really loves doing it and she's really good at it. So as she got those Female Storytellers reps under her, she started to think, you know what? I'm going to try stand-up. I'm going to try to actually do this. I've got jokes written. I'm funny. I can do this. And so that's really what I wanted to talk about, was getting through that initial stage where it's like, oh man, if this doesn't go well, And then just deciding over and over again to keep trying and get to the point where you're at something like Romo's show, which is a sold-out thing and everyone loves it, to get up there and to be really, really funny. Now, I had never spoken to Bethany before recording this podcast, and I can say that she's just as charming and delightful offstage as she is onstage. She'll be performing again with the Female Storytellers. If you're listening to this podcast when it drops, she'll be performing March 11th at the Flycatcher at 7 o'clock. Should definitely check that out if you haven't been to a Female Storyteller show yet. And also, Sunday was Bethany's birthday. So why not join me in singing, Happy Birthday? Oh wait, we can't. We'll get sued. Just say Happy Birthday if you see her around town this week. Now there's a pretty good chance you're sitting there listening to this thinking, boy, I love the Side Streets podcast. I wish there were ways I could interact with it online. Well, guess what? You can. We're on Twitter at Side Streets Pod. I'm on Twitter at NPreventis. The blog is sidestreetspodcast.tumblr.com, which has all the information you could ever need and more. We're on Facebook, like the Facebook page, Side Streets Podcast. And without any further delay, we go now to our conversation with Bethany Evans, which took place at the Hotel Congress.
Bethany Evans, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing real well. I appreciate you taking the time. Well,
thanks for having me.
So, where are you from originally?
Oh, God. I'm originally from Phoenix. Yeah.
I know. We don't have to get there. I will not hold that against you.
Please don't. I consider myself a Tucsonan at this point. I moved here in 2006.
What brought you here?
School. Yeah, University of Arizona.
So. What'd you study?
Political science.
So that's kind of the that's a nice transition into comedian.
Yeah, I guess so. You get used to like dealing with absurd situations and trying to make light out of it, I guess.
So what was your comedy background? Like, what would you say your entry point into comedy was?
Well, I'm involved with FIST, Female Storytellers, and while we're not necessarily comedy, that definitely got me interested in making audiences laugh. And that was when I kind of decided I wanted to try stand-up a few months ago.
I see. So when did you get involved with the Female Storytellers?
In April of 2013. Yeah.
So for anybody that's not from here, I mean, a lot of towns this size have similar kind of work. What's Tucson's Female Storytellers? Like, what's kind of the background?
Well, we actually started, Lauren Wiggins started Female Storytellers because she was doing stand-up and she got kind of tired of the sort of misogynistic culture that was going on, and she wanted to create a safe space for women to share their stories and also be funny at the same time. We basically have a show once a month, and it's a different theme every month, and we invite 5 women to write stories based on their real life and perform them. We do the show once a month. It's kind of like The Moth, if you've heard that. Oh yeah, so we definitely tell true stories.
Awesome. Yeah. How many people, like, what's kind of the crowd? Is it like the same faces, or do you see it growing?
Growing, for sure.
Awesome.
Yeah, we definitely have people who've been there from the beginning when we were just like DIY shows at Love Smack, and now we have a regular venue, and it seems like the audience just keeps growing.
And so if somebody is new to Tucson, where would they see you?
It's usually the second Wednesday a month at the Flycatcher. Yeah.
So that's where Romo's happens.
Exactly, yeah. Our next show is Wednesday, March 11th.
Cool.
And it's at 7 o'clock.
So when somebody comes there, like, what's if somebody wanted to get on the show, like, is there like a barrier between like somebody who's interested in your show and then somebody who wants to perform on your show? How does somebody make that leap?
Oh, man, that's a good question, because it's super easy. If you come to a show and you get inspired and feel like you want to be a part of it, just write a story for the next month's theme, and we always announce them at the shows. They're always on our website. And then you submit a draft to storytelling at fstorytellers.com, and then you'll get feedback, and we'll have a rehearsal. It's easy as that.
Okay, so how many people are kind of regularly involved?
At this point, well, we have a board of about 6 members, but the Fisterhood at large, like regular performing members, I would say it's between 20 and 30 now.
Like, wow.
Yeah, we have
that's a good group.
A big roster of veterans.
So what inspired you to take part, to join the Fisterhood, as you call it?
Again, that was Lauren Wiggins. She's a good friend of mine, and she just kept kind of bugging me to do it because she knew I liked to write. And then finally one of the prompts spoke to me, and I was like, okay, I can do this.
Do you remember the prompt?
Yeah, it was The Road Less Traveled. And I had a story about some mean girl politics that happened when I was studying abroad, and it went really well.
That's great. And so were you a performer, like, you know, like when you were a kid? Were you somebody that was always in like the school plays or
oh, yeah.
making people laugh, kind of a ham?
Big old Christmas ham, for yeah. sure. Yeah, I was in a lot of like church musicals as a kid, and then in high school I got into speech and debate, and that's a different type of, you know, speaking in public, but it definitely helps.
So that was never like a fear, you know, that they always say that's like the number one fear for people was giving a presentation, but that just never was a barrier for you?
I mean, I still get nervous, but then as soon as I'm on stage with a microphone, it turns into adrenaline.
Do you remember the first time you got a laugh from a crowd?
First time. Well, I mean, the first time was the first time I told a story with FIST, I guess. Yeah. I made a comparison of how study abroad is a lot like the real world, and you have all these archetype characters and how they interact with each other, and that got a laugh, and it was kind of like, oh, all right. And the first time I got a laugh doing stand-up was actually at an open mic night at the Surly Wench, and it felt really good.
So for somebody that hasn't actually, that maybe has always wanted to but never done it, what's that first laugh from strangers feel like?
Oh, it's a rush. It kind of feels validating, like, okay, I'm not just crazy. I actually should keep trying this. Because open mic can be really rough when you're just telling jokes to the same five comedians over and over and they've heard your stuff. Like, so when you actually do get a laugh from a stranger, it feels validating, I guess.
So take me back to your very first time, like the transition from the storyteller group to doing stand-up. What was the first time you did it?
The very first time was actually my storytelling group hosted an open mic night. And
so a pretty welcoming, safe atmosphere.
Exactly, yeah. I was like, well, I guess I'll try stand-up in front of people who've seen me tell stories because they're going to be supportive regardless. And it didn't go as terribly as I thought. The bartenders told me that I made them laugh, and that's always the number one crowd for me. And then I started doing open mic night. The first one I did was at the Flycatcher, and the local comedian Kevin Lee, he was actually a really big mentor for me in terms of encouraging me to sign up and putting me on the list and giving me advice. And I just kept doing open mics.
How many have you done so far? Because you haven't been doing it that long, and that's one of the big reasons why I wanted to talk to you, because you don't get to talk to somebody in the very, like, infant stages of stand-up.
Yeah.
Usually by the time they start talking on podcasts about it, they've been doing it for years.
Yeah.
So how long have you been doing it now?
Since November.
See, that's
so, like 5 months.
We can count it out later.
Yeah.
The listener will figure it out. So you've been doing it for a little while. Have you felt yourself getting better show by show? Or, like, when you continually go up, does it get easier?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I'm finally starting to find my voice a little bit. When I first started it, I felt like I'm being Bethany the comedian, and it felt kind of forced. And now I feel like I'm getting more comfortable with it. I can just have fun and not be so nervous.
Have you felt like, have the crowds been friendly? I don't know much about Tucson in comedy. I'm interested in comedy. I love Tucson. I haven't been to a ton of the stand-up shows. I've been to a few. So when you go up, are the crowds receptive? Like, what's the atmosphere like here?
And that really depends on which venue you're in. The crowds are usually pretty receptive. Sometimes, like, at open mic nights, if you go on too late, the crowd's definitely more interested in getting their buzz on and less interested in paying attention. And it's not that they're hostile, it's just they're not paying any attention. But for the most part, I think the crowds are really receptive, and they're there to have a good time.
So if you were to try to describe what Tucson's comedy community is like right now, what would you tell them?
Kind of a tight-knit bunch, I feel, for sure. You'll start to see the same people over and over, and they're really welcoming of newcomers. Like, if you're thinking about doing comedy, I would definitely recommend trying it, because no one sees a new face and says, boo, go home. It's the opposite. Like, oh, good job, keep trying, keep coming. Like, it's a really supportive, kind of tight-knit little community.
Because from what I can gather, I've been here since about 2005, and there's never been a comedy infrastructure, really. There's laughs, and then some pop-up shows for whatever venue kind of is receptive to the idea. Every once in a while, there'll be a few, like when Jericho was here.
Yeah.
Jericho is kind of a force of nature. And then every once in a while, maybe once every couple months, we get like a headlining touring, but like Tig Notaro was just here. From the time we're recording this, Kyle Kinane's going to be here. But those shows are kind of few and far between. So what would you like to see in this town to maybe coalesce the Tucson comedy community a little bit?
It'd be cool if we could have maybe a few more regular featured comedy nights as opposed to open mics. The open mics are great, but it's easier when you have an audience that's there specifically for that event. So, I mean, Romo Tonight is actually a really great thing for local comedy, I feel, because it draws a big crowd and everybody wants to have a good time. So I'd like to see maybe maybe just like a monthly structured show.
It's a tough one because a lot of the times, like, the audience feels like if they've seen comedy, they're good, like, for a while. So there'll be those stretches where you'll have a structured show, but you're only seeing other comics and their pals come. And so that's always been a barrier, that because you kind of beat your head against the wall trying to do something like this. And that goes outside. Like, this is separate from even writing the jokes and doing your material and thinking about being a comic. It's the idea of how are we going to organize this? And there are a few people right now doing a pretty solid job. Polly Casillas, very funny guy. He's got this massive Twitter following I didn't even know about until I got here. I was like, 75,000 people follow this guy? And then, like, Henry does a nice job getting people together. And there's like a few key kind of charismatic people that attract, I would say, that put themselves out there to support younger, or not necessarily younger, but newer comics.
Absolutely, yeah. So Henry's definitely one that's helped me personally, like, and, like, the Switch is a great thing. Stuff like that,
yeah,
that I know that they're both involved in.
So describe the Switch for somebody that hasn't been to that show.
Okay, it's kind of like whose line is it anyway, I guess. They do a show, I believe, once a month. And it rotates between Congress and the Flycatcher. And they have featured comics that show up, and the audience texts in topics, and they just put them up there. And every comedian gets 5 topics, and you have no idea what they're going to be until you're up there. And then you just improvise stand-up. And it's really fun. Like, it's fun because even if the comedian's bombing, it's still funny in a way.
Trying to watch them work through it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's an interesting conceit to require writing on the fly. Because a lot of the times you can kind of get stuck in your own head. And if you're forced to come up with something funny in front of people like that, almost that tightrope of that adrenaline of failure being a possibility. Yeah,
because that's not already present in pre-written comedy.
Sure, yeah, no, because that's bulletproof. Everybody loves it right away.
Oh man!
So, when you first started writing bits, like, did you have it in your head like, I'll have these like little bits in my head, and they'll be funny for me and my friends, or did you always want to do stand-up?
I've wanted to do stand-up for about the past year, which is definitely not as long as a lot of other comics. My friends are definitely the people I want to make laugh first and foremost, just because write what you know, right? As far as, like, writing bits, I carry, like, a little notebook around with me, and whenever something funny happens during the day, I'll just jot down a keyword, and then later I have this running doc of comedy that I just flush them out, and I try it. Before every open mic night, I write a little set list, and that's my process. And just try them out. Like, some jokes, they don't work at all ever the first 2 times, and that's when I just know not to try it again. If it works 2 out of 3 times, you know, there might be something there.
So it's that, it's feeling comfortable enough to fail in front of people.
Yeah.
Which is a really hard thing to do for a lot of people. A lot of people early on in stand-up overthink it. They overthink it to death, and they paralyze themselves thinking it has to be Louis C.K. level funny the first time I do it, or else why am I even putting myself up for this kind of humiliation? But you were ready to just go up there and do it. What was kind of the impetus for you? Just to do the experience, or was there something else driving you?
Well, I've been doing storytelling for over a year, and I love the format, but I was feeling a bit dried up creatively. Like, I think I'd told enough stories at that point, but I didn't want to just stop writing and performing because I am a big old ham. And comedy seemed like a natural, like, next step to take. And I also wanted to do it because it's so scary. Like, I think you should do things that really scare you. You might surprise yourself. Yeah.
So how have you surprised yourself in these last, like, 6 months or so?
By not being a humongous failure, like, only halfway of a failure.
Well, there's always a part in the podcast where I tell the person I'm talking to, what they did was great. Yay. And they get really embarrassed and bashful. And you just have to take the compliment.
Okay.
But the last Romo show, you opened it, and for somebody that, because you'd only been up maybe a dozen times, give or take, and you were really funny. You were funny, you know, but funny in a way where I felt like I was watching somebody who was comfortable in their own skin up there, which is a really hard thing to do early. And that was something I was really curious about talking to you about, how you got from Bethany Evans comedy persona to somebody that's up there telling stories that have punchlines to them. Was that always kind of the goal for you?
Yeah, for sure. That's been a constant goal, is trying to just seem natural, like I am being myself and not... Like, one of the early criticisms I got when I first started was that I was putting on a persona that seemed obvious. And they're like, just talk to the audience like you talk to your friends. It'll be so much better than if you try to be this ba-dum-tsh person that you're not.
Right. And something like that Romo show that we spoke about earlier is such an advantage, because he packs so many friendly faces in there. I mean, there are the same like 75 people that come to every Romo show, but then there's also another 100-ish people that it might be their first time, but they're all kind of on board, because I don't know what it is about him. There's this force of personality with Romo.
Oh yeah,
you all just kind of get on his wavelength.
The Romo show is great just because it has this still kind of anarchy, do-it-yourself yes. nature to it. That's very much what downtown Tucson needs. It's a huge advantage to go on that show.
And so when you're up there, because the set starts working, I would say probably your third joke in, and the stories are natural, but they're also, there's enough laughs in it to keep the momentum going. So when you're up there doing it, does it feel like it's going well, or are you just so lost in the material, you're just kind of tuning it out? Where are you at when it comes to, like, reading the crowd?
Well, like, it gets with that specific set for sure. At first I could tell, like, oh, no one's laughing, this is weird, I'm just gonna plunge straight ahead, I don't have a choice. And then when I got the first big laugh, that's when the momentum kicked in. Okay.
And you can also kind of feel
going with it. Yeah,
everybody else breathed a little easier too.
Yeah, for sure.
It's an interesting thing, especially, I don't know how it is in other cities with maybe more comedy, like not just even New York and LA, but say like a Portland or mm-hmm. a Denver, you know, other kind of mid-sized cities that already have established comedy scenes. I don't know what it's like there, but I know here, everybody wants to laugh. The crowd they don't want to boo you, they don't want to heckle you. Not, you know, if they get drunk enough, people will be drunk and stupid. But here, there's almost this, like, looking around at other people. Are you laughing yet?
Yeah.
Is it cool for me to laugh? If you laugh, I'll laugh. Because they don't want to be the first one to laugh, because then they'll look uncool and stupid, like they're laughing at something that's not funny. But they start looking around, and once everybody clicks in, everybody, because you breathe easy, and then the crowd breathes easy. And now we're just, for the next 5 minutes, you're talking to us.
Yeah,
it's good.
And that, it's a magical feeling when that, it's like a sigh of relief. Okay, we're all having a good time now. Yes.
Because it
you want to laugh, for sure.
It will be weirdly tense when, I don't feel any kind of joy when a comedian's bombing.
Oh, no. Feel more uncomfortable than probably they do.
And you just feel bad, and you can see, like, it's almost like they're drowning a little bit. They're just trying to get their head above water. That's not fun.
No.
And I've never understood the heckling thing. I feel like some people think they're contributing. Like, they're helping. I made it funny. Listen to how funny it was when he made fun of me. But the comic hates when you're doing that.
Well, yeah, because it distracts from where they're going. Mm-hmm. You know, they're trying to just get through this set that they have memorized. And when you're heckling, it shakes it up. Wow, where was I? Yeah.
Have you dealt with anybody trying to derail your show yet?
Actually, I've been pretty lucky, fingers crossed, so far. Yeah. Like, the only type of heckling I get is mostly just people that'll be in the crowd being like, hell yeah, or
right.
You got it, say it. Like, I haven't gotten anyone.
Your
like,
friends chiming in.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Especially after a couple drinks.
Yeah. But I don't go to laughs that often, and it has nothing to do with the quality of the club or anything. It's just, it's not always my sensibility. But the times I have gone, there are people in that crowd that seem like they go every week, that go specifically to heckle the comedian. And the people that come through laughs, they're touring comics. They hit the laughs equivalent in every city on the mm-hmm. way here and on the way back home. And so they've developed that crowd work muscle, because there's no other way to do paying comedy unless you're able to handle a crowd, because a lot of it's babysitting. And I remember we saw Rob Delaney when he was here. I've never seen his stand-up. I mean, I chuckled at a Twitter, a tweet of his or two, and just thought, I want to go see comedy. Let's go see this. And we thought it would be, he's a professional comic. The first 20 minutes of his set were honed to perfection. The next 40 were obviously, this was new material. And by the time he went up there, it's about 10:40 or whatever, some people had been overserved. And they felt like they were contributing to the set by yelling at him. And so I've never understood that impulse. And when you're in the crowd and you feel it start to turn, what are you thinking when you're there?
I'm thinking, if you think you're so funny, why don't you get up there?
That's
get a life, man. Yeah, I don't know.
Because so many people will, I mean, they're tough guys in the crowd, but they get up on stage, the light shining in their face, and their first joke doesn't work. And that wilting, that happens fast.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to heckle if you're not actually doing it, you know?
So, you said earlier, I didn't want to dwell on this, but I do want to bring it up. You said that female storytelling developed out of a necessity for it to exist because of maybe some ugliness in the community. Do you feel like that is still a problem here? Be as diplomatic as you like.
I think some people still think it's a problem here. It's also just kind of the nature of comedy. Nothing's sacred, so I think, if I go to an open mic night and I'm preceded by a bunch of rape jokes, part of me is like, well, you're going for the cheap laugh, but then again, I don't feel like as a woman, I'm shut out of the comedy scene either.
You don't feel necessarily threatened.
But exactly.
Not necessarily welcome in that, among that lineup.
And it's nothing personal. Sometimes just the material, I think, can get a little bit,
I feel like, you see this in comedy and, in society to a large degree, is just that generic male entitlement.
Yeah, exactly. So there it was and is, and that's why female storytellers has grown so much. Obviously, there is this need for a space for just the ladies to be funny and work it out and kind of show, we can be funny too. But I don't think that means that we can't infiltrate other forms of comedy too.
And it's not, there's always that generic, like whenever Adam Carolla will make that women aren't funny hot stir up every 6 months because, I don't know, the downloads on his podcast have gone stale. So he needs to stir something up again with something that is empirically false.
Yeah.
So when you're at these shows and it's like, dude, token woman, dude, it's not necessarily exclusionary on the surface. It's not on purpose, mm-hmm. but if you're a woman performing or a woman in the crowd and you haven't heard anything but like dude humor for 2 hours, that's a bummer.
It is, but in some ways I think it works out for me because the ladies are so excited to hear another lady.
And you're also just coming up
and with a different perspective. Yeah. Exactly. So
and you almost start killing just by virtue of not being the exact same as the same four dudes that told the same Louis C.K. kind of... And you'll see that also like in an open mic setting, and it's no fault of anyone's because everyone's just starting.
Right, yeah.
But you start adopting your heroes. You kind of you hear like a cadence. I've seen a Paul F. Tompkins or two come up there and try to do a... They'll speak in that kind of cadence, like very erudite. And then there'll be a Mitch Hedberg guy. There'll be a Todd Barry guy.
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting. That's always what's fun about going to open mics. If you can go ahead and deal with the three or four that shouldn't be up there, you can actually watch some people grow into a voice, and that's really exciting.
Yeah,
so
for
have,
sure.
But as you've been going to these open mics, have you seen that start to happen for people?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Who were some of your influences, maybe, as you first started going up?
Influences.
Maybe not influences, but like just people you that made you laugh.
Well, two of my heroes, I know it's cliche, but I gotta say Tina Fey and Amy Poehler.
Well, the best.
Definitely the best. Heroes of mine, because they've always kind of stuck in true to who they are, you know? Mm-hmm.
And they're super funny.
And they're super funny. Oh, obviously. Yeah, that too. I love Kathy Griffin's stand-up. I think she's really funny.
She's underrated.
Yeah, truly. And she does a storytelling aspect in her comedy that I would like to learn from.
I think there's a lot of people that get pigeonholed as like a sitcom character, like because she was on Suddenly Susan Forever.
Yeah.
You think that's her, but you actually see her do stand-up. She kills.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you already said it. I know it's the biggest cliche of all time, but Louis C.K. is probably my favorite contemporary stand-up. He's the best.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where every once in a while, somebody will kind of claim the throne.
Yeah, like it was Chris Rock in the 90s. Like,
yeah, and everybody just says, oh, Louis here. And then it's kind of the other end of that, where you're starting out, there's all these hurdles you have to clear. And once you get to that level, it starts being really hard to be funny because everybody is just ready to laugh the instant they see you. I mean, you don't even know if your material's any good at that point. Like, I know that's why, like, when Chris Rock starts prepping for a special, he'll go to the Comedy Cellar and do everything in a monotone. He won't sell it. He won't do the Chris Rock thing, because Chris Rock can make anything funny. But if it's new material, he just says it like this.
That's really interesting.
He doesn't put any dramatization to it. He doesn't act it in any way. He just says it like this.
Does
and if it gets a laugh this way, then he knows he can Chris Rock it in a stadium setting, and it's going to destroy. He'll know it works because it's funny, not because he's Chris Rock.
Wow. Does he do that thing where he announces to everyone, this is new material, guys?
Yeah, shut off your cell phones. Yeah, stop recording. I'm going to kick you out. You know, I saw Paul F. Tompkins at this thing in Austin, and it was a new hour. It still never came out. I don't know what's ever going to happen to it. I might be one of 300 people to ever get to see this thing. And we were front row, really excited. This is like one of the guys that's like the funniest to me. And these two guys, front row center, just sitting there with their cell phones, holding it up right in his face. And then he's like, can we not do that? And so then they put it on their lap. And he has to kick them out. But he doesn't miss a beat. I mean, it's incredible when you watch somebody that's been doing stand-up for like 20 plus years never even lose momentum, like stop the show and go right back into it like it didn't happen. It is crazy.
That's professionalism at its finest.
So have you ever felt like you were going to be derailed, or have you, as you've been doing stand-up, have you found a way to get to the end of your set every time?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I've gotten the light before, and that's always a good indication that you're done. Yeah. All right. I did have one night, the first night that I really remember bombing, and it was at open mic at O'Malley's, and I didn't go up until, like, almost 1 a.m., and it was embarrassing because I brought all my friends there to that show, which, of course, is the one that I'm going to bomb at because they're all there. And it was just a very drunk kind of frat-ish crowd, and I couldn't even hear myself over the shots for Jaeger bombs, and I was
you mean the perfect situation for comedy.
I should have just dropped the mic and been like, all right, someone buy me a Jaeger bomb, but for some reason
that would have gotten the biggest cheer.
I know, but I just kept going and it was painful.
But now that's something you have under your belt, like you did that.
Yeah, it's not the worst thing that happened.
Kind of the incredible thing about doing stand-up is every bad experience is now material for the next time you go do stand-up.
Yeah.
Or it's some sort of story you get to share with other stand-ups, and you all kind of become part of this community.
Yeah, that everybody bombs at least once.
And if you don't have a bombing story, then you're lying.
Yeah.
And nobody likes a liar.
No.
So how much how much material would you say? Like, how much, like, if you had to fill X amount of minutes opening for, say, Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, and that's, it's just you and then them, how much time could you do?
Oh, I could probably do 20 minutes.
20 confident minutes.
20 confident minutes. I have about 40 minutes of solid material, but 50% of it sucks. So probably 20 minutes.
You have 20 you feel good about.
Yeah, 20 Tina Fey, Amy Poehler minutes.
So what's the plan now? Like, where do you want to just keep doing it to do it? Or do you see any kind of, like, career maybe, or some sort of path that might, like, some sort of comedy path for you?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm still so new at this that it feels ridiculous to talk about.
Right.
A career.
But, you know, most stand-ups don't even end up doing stand-up. I mean, it's an avenue to something else.
Yeah. I mean, writing is definitely my number one goal. So if somehow I could ride this train, get some type of regular writing gig, that would be the dream, I guess. As far as in Tucson, yeah, I just want to keep doing it. I still actually need to do laughs. That's my next personal goal.
Get up during that open mic?
Yeah, that scares me, because I know you get 3 minutes, right?
And you get, and it's not your friends.
Yeah. It's, so. Maybe I'll have another awesome bombing story.
I think, and that, it's always, like you said, you know, testing yourself and getting out of your comfort zone to do stand-up initially. Then once you start getting comfortable and you've made all your friends laugh and made all the other comics laugh, go make some strangers laugh.
Yeah.
You know, that's a, you know, there's a whole other set of circumstances when it's like, even people that might not even know your frame of reference, can you still be funny to them?
Right? That is the test.
I mean, that's why I do this to one person, and then I do the intro and outro to a wall. No, there's no feedback unless somebody gets on Twitter to tell me it's good or it sucks. So I do like the idea of that instant gratification where it's like, I said this thing and immediately people have told me whether or not it's good.
That's an awesome feeling. Of course, there always is the other side of that.
And so where would you like to see Tucson's comedy community at in the future? Like, what do you think could take it maybe solidify it or help take it to the next to another level?
Oh man, I feel like I'm the wrong person to ask about this.
But if, let's say you're in charge.
I think, again, like, the open mics is great. I like that downtown is starting to get a comedy scene. If there were just a way to maybe make it slightly more organized, like just have something like the Switch, I guess, but with featured, like, not improv, like, instead of just like a random event once in a while, like, to have a place. I don't know.
And part of it, you have to have headliners that draw a crowd.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to, like, Romo doesn't do stand up. His variety show is an ideal platform, mm-hmm, for to provide a goal for comics to get on the Romo show. That's great. But in order for a comedy community to galvanize around a couple of key figures, like you saw that in Portland when you had, like, the Ron Funches and, you know, people of that level were, Ian Carmel. There's a few people that were starting to get noticed nationally, but that could raise the profile of those local shows. Like, they would have that thing at Helium. We don't have a Helium-type venue yet. And then you would see that maybe in Chicago when a group of comics would really start to draw. And so here, we've got some veteran... Like, who would you say are the most veteran comedians right now?
Here in Tucson?
Yeah.
Well, like you mentioned earlier, I think Pauly Casillas definitely is a name that can draw people in.
And he gets a lot of good, like... He'll like, middle for people up in Tempe.
Yeah, and Kevin Lee also is another veteran. He's been doing it for so long and has opened for some big names. And let's see. I don't know how long they've been doing it, but I know, like, Henry and Josiah are a couple names that I always see around that seem like they're getting...
They work real hard.
Recognition, yeah. They go to every open mic, practically.
And they do a lot of other things.
Yes, and maybe that's important, too, is kind of cross training. So yeah,
put your name in front of people as often as you can and in many different ways as you can.
Yeah.
Because if you're just doing comedy here, I mean, it's just sad to say that it doesn't quite register with the people outside of the community yet. So if you're able to do KXEI stuff, you're able to write for the Weekly, you're able to maybe pitch the Daily Star or something.
Storytelling.
Yeah, do the female storytelling. There's just a lot of... Because the thing about Tucson, for a city its size, there's so many things to do.
Yeah.
There's so many avenues to get on stage. There's so many communities to put yourself in. There's a lot of people that want to welcome you. And the only barrier for inclusion is your own anxiety or apprehension. You get over that, you can get on stage today.
Yeah.
And that's not like that in other cities.
No, that's true.
So if you were in L.A. or New York, do you think you would have been able to go up on stage? Or do you think it took a town like Tucson to provide those baby steps?
For me personally, I think it takes a town like Tucson.
Yeah.
I'm a ham, but I'm not crazy. I don't know.
There's a level of ambition that it takes to...
Yeah, and like, you know...
And you have to wait.
Mad props to like Jericho, for example, for moving to New York to try that and like...
But after getting years of this under his belt,
yeah.
He comes almost as a... He's not a finished product, but he's not brand new. He's not a lump of clay that hasn't done this at all.
Tucson's a great place to try things out, for
That's
sure.
a great way to put it. Because I know a lot of people used to leave here because they never thought they could make it. And now that making it's not even really a consideration for anybody in any creative endeavor anymore because there's no money anymore.
Yeah.
So people that used to leave here to go to Brooklyn or go to L.A., they move the other way now. There are bands that move here to play here. There are writers that instead of paying $1,600 a month to live in 240 square feet, they take $400 a month to live by themselves in a pretty reasonable place, and then you're able to devote some of that energy to a creative endeavor that isn't spent completely freaking out about money all the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
And it's not also spent completely freaking out that you're not as good as the people that go up every night at UCB or the Comedy Cellar. You know, all these professionals. I mean, the people that go up at UCB now, I mean, those people write for all the sitcoms you like. And here in Tucson, people go up because they really want to. Like, they just desperately, passionately want to be
yeah,
up on stage.
They all have day jobs.
Yeah, or evening jobs, or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever your clock is set to. But when you're up there, do you feel comfortable yet, or is there still kind of a finding your footing element?
I feel pretty comfortable. I would say I'm still finding my element, but I feel a lot more comfortable than I did even 2 months ago.
So 2 months from now, you'll look back at this time and be like, oh, this was garbage. What was I even doing?
I'll probably listen to this podcast and cringe.
Well, I hope Bethany doesn't listen back to this and cringe, because I found her to be absolutely delightful. That's going to do it here on the Side Streets podcast for another week. Episode 054 in the books. Thanks so much, Bethany, for coming on the show, talking all about your comedy experiences and influences. And the thing about Bethany, she's really funny right now, but there's no telling how funny she's going to be a year from now. So I'm really glad that she decided to do the podcast right now to talk about this stage of the comedy process. And if any other comics who might listen to this show want to come on, get at me at sidestreetspodcast@gmail.com. Get at me on Facebook. I want to talk more about comedy in Tucson. I want to get to know this scene a little bit. I've got a few people on my master list of guests. I'm all booked up to the end of April, but I want to start getting some comedians on the show talking about what it's like to do comedy here in Tucson. Now, before you contact me, you got to ask yourself, am I funny? Because I'm not going to talk to anybody that's not funny. I'm not wasting your time, my time, or anyone else's time. You better be funny. Taking us out this week is a track from one of my favorite Tucson bands, Otherly Love. Now, y'all remember Ben Schneider from episode 037 from the Night of the Living Fest? Otherly Love is his band. Yes, in addition to all the bands he plays drums in and miscellaneous instruments, Ben also finds time to record on his own thing.
And Otherly Love has this really cool No Bunny, Jay Reatard kind of vibe. And what we're going to hear right now is the lead-off track Sleep from this new cassette that he put out on Sunday. You've been listening to the Side Streets Podcast. My name is Nick Provenis, and we're going to find something fun to do.